sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
There's trouble brewing in Europe. Markets drop for the week. We're seeing some economic bright spots, though. And our guest, Kevin Hoffman, today, we're going to be talking about disruption and destruction when it comes to technology. All this and much more on episode number 419 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello there, Andrew Horowitz, and this is the Disciplined Investor Podcast, end of June 2015, and man, we got some action in markets, in particular after the close of the market on Friday. We saw that there was a kind of a crazy announcement by the Prime Minister of Greece saying that, hey, we're going to hold a referendum and let the people decide. So all of this negotiation has gone on for months and months, and the various changes and redos, we're in, we're out. All of that is going to come down to some of the vocal voices and the will of the people, which seems a bit crazy to me, because with all of the potential for the very fine details of the deal, on July 5th, there's going to be a vote. Now, by the way, this is well past the time when Greece needs to pay back the IMF the $1.7 billion, which is on June 30th. They remember they bundled that together with all the other debt that was payable, and they supposedly were going to pay that on June 30th. And now the referendum is on July 5th. Already because of this, there is a big concern that they're going to be too late and there'll be funding cut off by the ECB. And there's been some back and forth over the weekend. There's been discussion that, well, we're going to continue to provide the ELA, which is the assistance to the banks, and that assistance is in the form of keeping banks floating with all deposits coming out, because a lot of outflow has been happening. And we saw that over the weekend there was a bit of a bank run. About 70 ATMs were drained out of the 2,000 or so in the country, and now we're going to be looking at what happens, probably going to see some severe market turmoil in Europe in particular, due to the fact that there is probably going to be a banking holiday on Monday because banks will not be open holding back cash, even though the ECB has said they're going to freeze, not stop, but freeze the levels of the ELA. That's a good thing because they're going to still provide some liquidity to the banks throughout this process, but it seems that the confusion that is going to come due to this is going to be very disruptive. I'm sure that we're going to see at least the futures get hit pretty hard in terms of the various currencies and the European stock markets. And I would venture to say that there's some concern over here as well on the heels of a pretty ugly week as it was to begin with. We did see that the markets did sell off over the week, and a lot of this is being blamed on the whole impasse with Greece and its creditors. Global equity markets, of course, were also down. Now, over the past 5 days, that week that was, the Dow gave back about 0.4%, the NASDAQ lost about 0.71%, and the S&P 500 down about 0.4%. Now, consumer spending was up about 0.9% over the week. This May gain represents quite a change from the 0.1% improvement that was recorded by the Commerce Department for April, so that's good. Households are feeling more optimistic these days. We're seeing that the University of Michigan announced a final June reading of 96.1, and that was the highest mark since January. That's good. Housing market also was a bit better, hit a high since 2008, an annualized pace of new housing at 546,000. That's very good also. There was also some benefits seen in the GDP. Even though GDP was weak, there was a bit of a silver lining showing that possibly GDP numbers are going to be a little bit better. And the GDP number that came in on the revision was at 0.2 versus 0.7. So that's the final. We're going to get to a guest. We have Kevin Hoffman with us today, and we'll spend some time with him. And then we'll talk a little bit more about some potential for portfolio hedging and how you can actually hedge your portfolio somewhat right now, and talk a little bit about that after we finish up with our guest. All right, a special guest, a guy that hasn't been around on the show for some time. He's been working hard in the background, sometimes in the foreground, but somehow just not on the microphone. Kevin Hoffman, he works with me and is generally doing all the work that makes Horowitz Company look all so good. How are you, buddy?
I'm doing great. And you?
I am good, thank you. We were just talking about how ridiculously hot it is here in Florida. Did you notice that, like, I don't know, it was 2 weeks ago? It was like all of a sudden out of nowhere this dome of humidity came over and blanketed the whole area, and it's been just ridiculously hot since.
Yeah, so as you know, I've been training for this Chicago Marathon that's going to be coming up, and it is becoming increasingly more difficult to run either in the morning or even at night, because even at 6:30 a.m., it's almost 90 degrees.
I know.
And unbelievably humid.
So I took a run yesterday afternoon. I went out there, and about halfway through it, I was like, oh, that's awful. But no, I know what you mean.
Very sweaty.
So actually, yesterday also went, I think I told you, after work, I went out to the Apple store because I wanted to just check out some of the things that were there. I was thinking about getting a new laptop. And one of the things that I wanted to see was, and I wanted to touch, was the watch, the actual Apple Watch. Because, you know, I've been wearing this really cheap, you know, Fitbit knockoff from Xiaomi. And so I checked it out.
So what did you find?
Well, I was disappointed. I was sorely disappointed. So I touched the watch, and I'm kind of playing with little buttons, and I started asking one of the guys in blue shirt about it. And I'm like, okay, so let me understand a little bit about this. So I take this, and I want to go for a walk, a run, a bike ride, or whatever else it is. What's the story with music? Well, they said you could synchronize your music up to 2 gigabytes of music onto the phone, onto the watch. I said, okay, that's interesting. And what about like streaming, Pandora, things like that? Well, the watch can operate those different things, whereas I guess you need your phone, and you take your phone with you, and then somehow you attach your Bluetooth headset maybe or something to your watch or to your phone. I said, well, but you need your phone still. Yes, that's true. And then, okay, well, what about email? Well, you can read your email, at least part of it, the summation of it. And I said, what about replying?
But that's only if you have your phone with you, right?
Only if you have your phone and you can't reply.
Right. You can't reply.
No.
You can't even talk in
no.
there.
No. No.
I thought there was a microphone you could talk in and it would bring text out, no?
Maybe you could text, but I don't think you could. I tried to push buttons. There was no push button to reply for email from what I saw.
Interesting.
So then I asked a bunch of other questions about it, and it was like, okay, yeah, but you need your phone. And every answer was, oh, yeah, but you need your phone.
Right.
I said, well,
if I have my phone, then what's the point of having the watch?
Exactly.
Did you find that it was very small, too, yeah, that it was cumbersome, that you couldn't really, you know, touch particular spots or spaces?
It wasn't that hard, because what you could do is you could do the pinch and zoom. So you can open it up a little bit and get those little microscopic program app buttons
right
on the phone. You could touch it. But then on the side, there was also the rotating. It was like kind of the old time watch winding, the winder where you would, make it, you'd wind it up. That thing is more of a zoom.
Yeah.
And there's a button on the side. And again, I was like, okay, so what is this really good for? Well, it's good for like health and monitoring your health, because it has the health monitors on the underside of the watch. You know,
but what is it actually monitoring? Is it only your beats per minute, as well as some accelerometer that does some
GPS? I think in it.
Does have GPS.
Yeah, but again, you have your Apple iPhone has a GPS also and an accelerometer.
Right, but so the only thing it doesn't have is the heart rate monitor.
I don't think it. Well, unless
the phone. I'm saying the phone doesn't have a heart rate.
Right, the phone doesn't have the heart rate monitor. I guess this does. If there's a vein underneath your wrist right there, because it's got to be on a vein, right?
Well, yeah. So the watch has a heart rate monitor.
It does, because there's some kind of a...
Which is the problem they had with the tattoos, right?
Oh, yeah, exactly. So you have that, and there's a bunch of other apps. But again, everything was, oh, you have to have your phone with you. I'm like, well, I don't get it. Like, if I have to have my phone with me to do all these things, what's the benefit? Well, you don't have to take the phone out of your pocket. I'm like, so I have to pick my arm up. I have to pick my arm up to look at something, like who's calling, whatever. I can't just reach back 6 more inches to my pocket and grab it if the phone's not out. I didn't get the whole thing.
Yeah, so I'm trying to figure out what the benefit of it would be. And for me, as far as being, you know, into fitness and whatnot, I found that, you know, looking at some of the other type watches that are fitness specific, like a Suunto or a Garmin Forerunner, right, yeah, or something like that, mm-hmm, would seem like a better option for this. And then you could maybe conglomerate it into Apple's health program.
Right.
But for now, it seems the big concern for me would be, one, battery life. That's always...
battery life and the pain in the ass of having to charge it all the time.
Right, and that's one big issue. And the other issue is that the fact that it's not waterproof.
Oh, so don't get me started with that.
I don't even know if you can go into the shower with the thing. You know, I think it certainly can't be in the pool. I know that.
I think it's water resistant. I think now I'm not remembering this, but I think there was different models that were more water resistant than others, which then you have to pay a lot more money for. And the thing is that I was out last night with dinner with somebody, and I looked, and lo and behold, he had an Apple Watch on it. I said, "Hey, how do you like that? Can I see it?" He goes, "Don't get me started." That's what he says. I'm like, "Why?" He says, "He can't even show it to you right now. The battery's dead." So he's wearing this thing. He's wearing this thing with the battery dead. And he said, on top of that, he can't figure out what to do with it. You know, what really the benefit of this is. He's been wearing it for a few weeks or whatever.
Right.
So I'm kind of, you know, wondering, you know, I know that was a big explosion to initially buy the watch and to have the watch and all, but I just don't really understand the utility of having this kind of device. Maybe it's the early stages of it, maybe.
Right. Well, I could see that. I mean, and everybody goes through those stages. I mean, even Garmin and Suunto and all them came out with these smart watches that had terrible battery lives and didn't have, you know, altimeters, barometers, GPS trackers inside of them, and you know, they've made the various iterations, but you know, now you're talking about a big leap forward with a touchscreen and the fact that it's got the heart rate monitor built into it.
Right.
So, you know, I think over time, I think if they can develop this and refine some of the areas on it, it could be a very good product. It's just right now it's not.
Right. If it had a GPS built in, if it had also the ability to, I guess, to have I guess the ability to do, maybe it does Wi-Fi, but not, you know, phone signal. So now what you have is a Nano, or you have like a mini iPad, like a really small iPad,
right,
baby little iPad with 3G and stuff like that, and you put it in your wrist. Anyway, so I'm sure there's some people out there that are all sort of freaked out right now that we don't know what we're talking about when it comes to this. But again, this is just man on the street observation. This is not technical analysis of the actual inner workings of this device or the potential future. I'm talking about the right here, right now, man on the street, what I saw at the store, what I've heard from other people. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on it out there. If you do, you can always write me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com or blow up my Twitter stream if you feel compelled to do so at Andrew Horowitz, one word, is the handle on Twitter. So you can do that. Let's get into some other topics I want to talk about, and I have a few different things. I guess we'll go right from one kind of technology issue to another, and we got to talk about Uber for a second. A few weeks ago, I had somebody on talking about the whole idea of technology disruption and disruptive types of technologies. Clearly, Uber is the one that's the poster child for that initially. There's plenty of others out there. But Uber has now gone from technology disruption to property destruction. In France this week, there was protests that were actually out of control where they were burning rubber tires and making the city look black, fires everywhere, pulling people out of cars that were supposed Uber drivers, clogging up traffic like crazy. There was also another incident. Where was that other incident, Kevin?
I think it was in Strasbourg.
Yeah, Strasbourg.
I want to say it was there, and one of the taxi drivers decided to take an Uber ride and had him take him to an area that was inconspicuous or where all his other taxi cab gang member guys were. And beat
the taxi
him up.
Crew.
So yeah. It's you know, it's an interesting mix of these taxi cab drivers versus these Uber drivers, and you know, obviously there's a lot of regulations, and this is something that's been probably beat to death in the media, but it's very interesting watching this unfold because Uber is so revolutionary as far as how things are going to be done going forward as far as transportation. And even worse is, you know, when we start to have driverless cars, like when you talked to that guy in the past about how that would totally disrupt any kind of a taxi service or automotive industry or trucking industry for that matter.
Well, but Uber, you know, clearly has the one mistake the taxi industry made was that in my opinion at least, was that they were lazy, sitting on their butts, not doing anything different, and they allowed for this technology to come through because of the
It was a monopoly.
Right, but if the taxi company would have come through with some great technology based on smartphone apps and computers and all that, this would have never happened.
I'm not even sure if that's the case, though, because I don't remember the last time I've had a pleasant taxi cab ride, whether it be the car or the driver or the smell.
Odor.
Yeah.
Odor.
And every time I've gotten into an Uber car, most, I'd say 95% of the cars have been clean. The drivers have been courteous, kind, and actually better drivers than most of these taxi cab rides. I mean, I don't know about you, but when I've gotten to a couple taxi cabs either in Chicago or Fort Lauderdale, they are heavy on the brake. On the gas.
Yeah, well, it's because they use both feet at the same time.
Yeah, and, you know, at least with Uber, I mean, you know, you never know,
what kind of driver you got. Yeah, yeah,
exactly. But still, I've had a much more pleasant experience in an Uber ride than a taxi cab driver.
Yeah, well, and you don't have that that screen in front of you. Oftentimes, it's not as squeaky as much the cars. Obviously, the odor, as we've mentioned before, due to the fact that the cars have been in service for a couple hundred thousand miles versus, you know, a lot of these Uber cars are much newer, or at least the drivers are newer, so therefore the cars have not been as abused as much. But I guess the point is that in Broward County, as a matter of fact, there was an ordinance passed just the last week that there was you can no longer pick up people from the airport. Now, whether or not we can get around that whole thing by putting the pin somewhere else and all that, the fact is that they have done that, and now they're pursuing a legal action against Uber because of the regulations. Now, personally, I think that Uber should be following the regulations that are set forth, whether it is requirements for insurance, you know, and this is as a company and the drivers, the requirement for registration, and which means a payment to the county or to the state or to the, you know, to the whatever governmental agency. I think that they should be. I don't see there's any reason why they should be able to skirt the rules. Do you?
I would tend to agree with you, but I think they are skirting the rules in the fact that they're making it a peer-to-peer type rideshare program, where it would be the same thing as you saying, hey, Kevin, can you take me to the airport and here's $10 for gas? How is that any different?
Because if I asked you to do that and then several other people asked you to do that and you made a regular job of doing that, then therefore it becomes a business.
I see.
Am I wrong?
No, I don't disagree with you. I'm just saying that's how they're skirting the rules.
Right, but the point is that, you know, it is, if it's a one-off and it's a favor, and if I pay you for gas, and I get that. But yeah, the truth of the matter is,
it's very similar to the music industry.
Well, what about taxes? If you're, you know, they're not collecting any taxes either on this whole deal. So
right, but they are being paid as a 1099 employee, so they still are paying.
But there's no sales tax. I'm talking about sales tax.
Oh, sales tax.
You know, if you have if you, for example, have you know, whatever particular, again, whether it's taxable or not, depending on your state, your county, your region, whatever it is. But if there is a requirement for that particular type of service to collect a certain type of sales tax because it is a service, it's a sale, et cetera, then they're not doing that either. So I don't understand where the whole, I don't understand how their model gets away with this. And
frankly, I would be surprised if they're not charging sales tax. Is that true?
I don't recall seeing a sales tax on my Uber bill.
On your bills?
Unless it's embedded somewhere, but usually it's the ride,
right.
It's the time, it's the distance,
and the $1 safety.
Yeah, the $1 something or other.
I don't understand that.
I don't know what that is either, but it's whatever fee is, and that's pretty much it, right? So that's your charges,
right?
And so again, you know, when you look at these things, when you look at these kind of, and there's not that many out there, but okay, yeah, good example. So you mentioned about music. So let's look at this. So the music industry being taxi services,
right?
Taxi companies,
mm-hmm.
And then the peer-to-peer sharing is no different than, hey, Andrew, can I borrow your CD for the day?
Exactly.
Or difference would be if I said, okay, I'm going to buy a CD.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to make 7,000 copies of them.
Right.
And I'm going to then sell it to everybody at $3 a piece instead of the $20, let's say, or MP3s or whatever it is. That music sharing really isn't legal either. There's another copyright infringements with that. I'm not talking about that side.
Right.
But the whole point of it is then someone is cut out. Now, there's no copyright. There's no intellectual property. There's no any kind of specific right of a taxi driver to drive a cab, right? You know,
right.
They didn't create the cab. They didn't create the idea of travel and all that. But again, for the service side of it, it would seem to me that, you know, you can't just copy any kind of product and then resell it without the proper parties getting paid, without the taxes being paid, without the proper registrations, insurance, licensure, and all of that. I do think that the taxi service, the way it is structured today, should be feeling a lot of shame.
I would tend to agree with you.
You know, so, and everywhere. I mean, everywhere at that. So, you know.
Well,
I mean,
and maybe this is a good way for the taxi cab industry to be shaken up a little bit.
It's a freaking wake-up call. It's a humongous wake-up call.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, and there's stats out there showing that they've lost, you know, 40 to 50, maybe even 60% of their revenue due to this. And, you know, the fact is that, you know, the music industry had to change in order to add all these various different online models or subscriptions, which, you know, seemed to work very well with Apple in the fact that they came in with iTunes, and that kind of changed everything, you know, after looking at somebody like a Napster or, you know, uTorrent and all these other different sharing methods.
Not that you ever use those.
No. You know what, college, yeah. I did use Napster.
Oh, Napster, of course. That was the best.
It was.
Okay, so let's kind of, we beat that topic up, and obviously the Uber drivers are getting beat up themselves, both psychologically and physically these days. But we'll see more of this happening. I hope it doesn't spread much more, because it is kind of ugly and unnecessary to be beating up an Uber driver, for God's sakes. I mean, they're just trying to make a living. That's just a little bit insane.
If anything, we should be protesting the company if you want
right,
to do
exactly.
that.
Right, exactly. Let's talk a little bit about a couple different things I want to talk about. Let's talk about inflation for a second. We're kind of making a huge segue somewhere different here. But it does have something to do with this whole disruptive technology, disruptive types of services. So as an example, let's just talk about shopping. And everybody out there knows that, generally speaking, I don't like to go to stores. I much prefer to utilize like an Amazon or whatever other online service it is, particularly one that has a free return policy. Also with a quick delivery service so that, you know, if I need to buy something quickly, fine. But one of the benefits of online shopping, aside from convenience and all that, is the ability to have a much greater degree of shopping, true shopping, comparative shopping experience, where I can look for the better price or even a reasonable price versus some places. For example, if I was to buy paint at an Ace Hardware because I needed in a pinch, maybe I'm going to pay $8. If I went to the same paint and I bought it at Home Depot, maybe I'll pay $5. But maybe if I went to Amazon or wherever else, maybe I'll pay $4, let's say, or even $5, something, you know, whatever the reasonable price is. But with the internet, I can actually tell what the pricing should be, what the right price is, right? So now I bring up the word inflation in this, because this whole lack of inflation discussion that's going on and the inability for us to see any kind of real significant inflation across all boundaries, according to the Fed's official product that they're looking for, is very interesting. And I wonder if some of the things that are going on today, and particularly related to the internet, et cetera, is causing us to have muted inflation.
Oh, and it definitely is. And I think you made up some very good points there in the fact that, you know, Google has a comparative shopper. You type in your product, and it brings up, 100 different retailers from across the nation that are willing to ship that product to you. Now, the shipping costs become a big issue, and that's when, you know, things like Amazon Prime or free shipping or various coupon codes that you can use make it work out. But the transparency in pricing and the fact that, you know, companies can no longer mark up their products to an extent that they are taking advantage maybe of the consumer is a real issue in inflation. And I think that's something that's developed over the past, call it, 5 to 10 years since the age of the internet and the refinement of your shopping shopping on the internet. People are becoming more comfortable and whatnot. So I do believe that inflation is kept at bay with certain products and services for that particular reason. And one other point that's interesting to make is that, you know, many companies are starting to do pricing that is, regulated across the board. So that,
what do you mean? What do you mean regulated?
So, like with Apple, if you sell an Apple product, such as the Apple Watch or an iPhone or whatever, if you want to be a retailer of Apple products, you can't sell that product at a price lower than, call it, $300.
Now, isn't that? Wait a minute. I hear that, but isn't that illegal?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure why it would be illegal if everybody's selling at the same price.
Well, the problem is that if you have everybody selling at the same price, for example, you have a bunch of gas stations on the corner, and they say, "Hey, nobody sell gas less than $2.20." I think there's some kind of price fixing, and it's really illegal to do that. But
and I think that may only be with products where there isn't a substitute product. Let's call it, milk, eggs, bread, something like that, or produce, where one can fix the price across multiple stores. And I think
it's a monopoly.
Well, it's also coming from the manufacturer and not necessarily a collusion of multiple stores. Up north we have Jewel Osco and Dominick's, and down here you have Winn-Dixie and Publix. You know, Winn-Dixie and Publix couldn't come together and say, hey, we're going to take milk and have it be at this price and have it be marked up 50% above whatever the market value may be. Whereas with an Apple product, it's a regulated price across the board.
It's an Apple product. They can do whatever the hell they want anyway.
That's true. But, you know, as far as affecting inflation, that totally affects it in the fact that there's a lot more transparency. Now, with services and whatnot, there hasn't been that kind of transparency. Whereas, some companies may be moving into something like that, like an Angie's List, or recently we just saw Amazon has Amazon Services.
You could get house cleaners, car washers, various
landscapers
from Amazon.
Right. And it's all priced based on your area. So, I think the places that we need to watch where inflation is becoming an issue, and this is where I'm seeing inflation become an issue, is in healthcare, in college education, or even any kind of an education program, whether it be private or public, as well as home prices. We had this discussion the other day about, back in, the 50s and 60s, we were able to purchase a home for maybe one time whatever your salary might have been.
Right.
Whereas these days, most kids or most even young adults or adults coming out of college or even saving money, the cost of an average home is maybe 2 to 3 or even 4 times whatever their yearly salary might be.
The multiplier factor kind of got out of whack.
Exactly.
Yeah. But that actually leads us into something else, this whole idea of what is disruptive. And in terms of the inflationary impact, where we have this whole idea that, well, if you have the trend, again, we're mentioning certain names like an Amazon or an eBay. I mean, that's not particularly, it doesn't have to be that. It could be other names as well, whether, you have Pinterest that maybe is doing some kind of deal with selling things and showing you greater ability to not only transparency, but greater ability to get more information. That's what it is. It's really the data mining of the information and availability of it. But when you look at the whole aspect of being able to find more information out, and is that good or is that bad, by the way? Because sometimes some things are left better kind of behind the scene and all. But here's the deal. This whole new advent of advice, financial advice, has recently come and provided an upswelling in the past, we'll call it the last year, but really in the past 6 months, there's been this whole robo-advisor concept, which is basically this idea that it's very easy to invest. All you have to do is answer a series of questions from a risk tolerance and time frame and all that. And then somehow magically you get a portfolio that is generated for you. And in some of the ones that are out there, they're a little bit easier, more basic, and a different aspect. Some are a little bit more complicated, et cetera. But I want to talk to you a little bit about robo-advising, which is still in the infancy and in the beginnings of all this. But, and talk about, what's happening with that area. So give us a quick take on very basic, what is robo-advice?
Well, I think it's first to try and best to discuss, how did this come about and why is this becoming such a popular topic? And I think a lot of that has to do with people that are millennials or, my age or younger, having a total lack of trust for the typical financial advisor.
And for the institution as a whole, I think we're
exactly,
talking about,
for
right?
the institution, whether it be, various custodians or whatever, because I think in the past, with this age of information and being able to see what certain things are, people never really knew how much they were being charged for a mutual fund or a life insurance product or whatever financial product it might be. And now we have these, various different websites that offer these investment programs that have extremely low fees and offer a very simple, basic approach that anybody can understand at a very low cost. And that has really brought good publicity toward my generation and younger in the fact that now we've got this program set out, it's structured, and also it requires very low minimums. You know, some of the places are only requiring $5 to open an account.
$5?
I think so. Yeah,
Come on.
I think some.
How can you diversify?
People
$5?
Like Wealthfront and Betterment.
How do you do that?
I'm not sure. I really don't know. I mean,
$5. You can't get partial shares of an ETF. Anyway, but you know what? Let me say something. Your generation, or the generation, the younger people, whether the millennials or whatever else it is, you know, let's not make the mistake, seriously, that, you know, the whole idea that cheaper is better, or that because it's lower cost is the only criteria. And I'm not making a defense for anything, but I'm just saying we need to make sure we focus on that you still have to have the quality there. You still have to have the insight. You still have to have the knowledge in terms of what is the best product. And sometimes it's nothing. There's nothing if it's not a commodity. If it's not like we're trying to just buy, for example, a bottle of Windex, and it's the 16-ounce bottle, and it's a dollar here, and it's 50 cents there, and it's $3 there. Well, hello, I'm going to buy the ones 50 cents, okay? But unless you have a commodity, and what they're trying to do is commoditize financial advice, mm-hmm. or somewhat to a
degree. Well, commoditize investment management.
Right. And that's interesting, and I think there is a place for that. And if, in fact, you can start off with something that, let's say if you only had $5,000 to invest, and you know, advisors don't want to talk to you. You know, stockbrokers are probably no time for you either. You probably don't even qualify for certain accounts to be opened. And if somehow this does, and it gives you at least a broad-based diversification, hey, I'm all in favor. Right. But let's not mistake this for the fact that this is not wealth management, first of all. Okay. And it just because it's cheaper doesn't mean it should be, okay, that's where I'm going to go and screw everybody else. There is something to be said about when you are working with, whether it's an attorney, whether it's an accountant, whether it's a financial advisor, there may be something that they could bring to the table that could be very helpful in this whole thing. Again, I'm not defending this. I'm just saying some facts here.
Yes, I would definitely agree in the fact that there are a lot of nuances that, you know, most people don't know, and they don't want to, you know, be taken advantage of. But when you only answer, let's call it 10 to 12 questions, and it spits out a portfolio for you consisting of, you know, 8 to 10 different ETFs, it's hard to really, I don't know how to say it, but it's hard to really grasp that and really hold on to it as a solid investment philosophy.
Right.
You
so
might
it's like,
say.
It's like going into a doctor's office, answering some questions, 10 questions versus, you know, having the meeting with the doctor and then going and having automated surgery on something that you may or may not need. You know what? My stomach hurts. Yes, I'm a little bit dizzy. Okay, you know what? We're giving you an antibiotic. Or you know what? You give us one answer that's a little bit different. Oh, it hurts a lot. It really get a pounding pain. You know what? We're doing an emergency appendectomy on you right now.
Right.
Without going through the much more where the doctor touches, feels, talks to you, understands more about what it is. I mean, it all depends. Now, if in fact you have a cold, if it's true that you have a cold, and you have a fever, and you can answer those questions, that's the only thing that's going on, let's say. It's not some kind of horrible disease of any sort or whatever. And you can answer those questions, and it's equivalent of going to a pharmacy and just getting a dispensed drug to help you through that. You know, you get a Z-Pack, whatever else you get. I got that. That's robo-advice. But you know what? The next stage where you can't shake it, or markets change dramatically, and you know there's something that, or for that matter, your risk factors change dramatically. All of a sudden, maybe a member of your family passed away. The whole thing is taken out in terms of the risk factors, where you need money for, et cetera. Now you can answer the questions differently again, and it can rotate. But there still is something to be said about having a knowledgeable person, because if not, none of us in any career are worth crap. Because almost any career, and listen, look what happened to the music industry. So let's go back in time where we had full orchestras, right? You had I don't know, let's call it 100 people that are playing music. Fast forward, we got Rush. You got three guys banging on instruments that are making an enormous noise. Yeah, some of it. But they're still playing it, and they're still playing with music and all that. Fast forward, you have... what's the name of the concert, the rave concert down in Miami?
Oh, World Winter Music Conference, or WWMC.
Yeah, but it's called, what's the one that with all the with the Guetta and all those guys?
That's Winter Music Conference. Oh, Ultra.
Ultra, yeah.
Ultra.
So there, what do you have? You have a guy basically pushing a button and play, and he may have cut some music together from various noises and various beats, but there's no longer instruments per se. So he came full circle from a 100-piece orchestra to Guetta or Deadmau5.
Where it's just a push-play.
Push-play and all that, and you got music that comes out, and they were like all happy about it and all that. So that's great. I don't know what the next version is, but the fact is that that's kind of where we are. You know, you went from maybe a pen and paper method or pen and paper calculator type of, you know, okay, this is what you need to do, how you need to do it, where you need to go, to the advent of computers allowing for asset allocation, all the way to robo-advice, which is the push-button play. So you go to Ultra, and before you get to Ultra, by the way, there's a little kiosk there. You can do your financial planning on the way in. Okay, you do all that stuff right there. You get there through an Uber car, by the way, which you, of course, push the button on your Apple Watch and said, Uber, I want you to get here right now. So basically, you have three things on you, and you go, and no longer do you have... And by the way, you eat in a fast food restaurant because no longer a need for... or a dispensary of some sort, right? And you kind of go on and on with this, and you go through tolls as you get there, and you don't need a toll taker anymore because nobody takes to get the thing. So essentially, we're all out of jobs.
Pretty much.
Besides the few that are making some music, and then, you know, maybe we have artificial intelligence and all that that allows for us to do... I mean, the whole thing kind of gets to a point of... what the generation that you're talking about is why they're embracing this is because they have been brought up without interaction to people. Now, maybe not you exactly, but the next generation, there's less and less actual face-to-face, touchy-feely interaction with people, much more ability to interact through an interface. And by the way, it doesn't really matter who's on the other end.
To an extent, yes.
I mean, I get it. Why not? If I can have a robot...
Well, isn't that the same thing as having call centers in Philippines or India or whatever? Well,
but why do you even need the call centers? Once you get to the point of having some kind of ability to have... Although none of us can take the whole voicemail trees or the where you go, you know, press one for this, press two for that.
The robot.
Yeah, the robot. You're 12 deep trying to get... trying to get to where you're going. But that's where the whole point is, that's why this generation, you know, I don't want to say they're doomed or anything like that, but they've got to have the ability to bridge both sides, embrace the technology and embrace the facts and the artificiality of things and all that, and the commoditization of certain things, but also at the same time have the ability to have relationships and service. Otherwise, waiters and waitresses, what do you even need a waiter or waitress for?
You really don't.
I mean, you know.
Unless you know you're old school and you want to say, "Hey, how's the fish today?
Right.
Is the fish fresh?
Yeah,
you know, or what's looking good on the menu today?" Which, to be honest, for me, if I ask that question, they're always going to give me the high price, and that's the distrust.
So what's good on the menu?
So what's the best bottle of wine? Or what's a good wine? Here's the $150 bottle.
So if you said so, what's best? Oh, the lobster Thermidor. You must have the lobster Thermidor,
right.
The double portion, the large one.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you're thinking that they're going to, and the purpose of that is to just boost their own tip.
Could be.
Right. And they're taking you over, just taking you.
Or it's the restaurant saying, okay, why don't you go out? We need to sell this today because this is going to spoil, or this is going to do that. I mean, that's been going on for ages.
Right.
Let's be honest.
And we're all fine.
Well, it's not that we're all fine. It's just, you know, maybe I want to make a choice for myself.
Oh, crap.
Maybe I want to.
No.
Maybe I want to look at the menu and I want to say, "Hey, I want that."
You want the pork chop special.
You know, I want to do the research. I want to look at it. I want to see what it is that I want to have.
So you got the iPad on the table instead of the waitress. Right. You know, Alice chewing gum coming over the table with the pad and pencil. And by the way, what is with the whole fine restaurants where waiters don't have pads to write stuff down? They just memorize everything. I find that annoying.
Why is that?
I just feel like...
Are you worried? Are you nervous that you're not going to get the right...
I don't need them at that point. If they're not going to write something down and do anything but stand there and be an intermediary between myself and the kitchen, right. All I need to do is on my watch, say I'm at this restaurant and say I want the pizza with pepperoni on it and I want it now.
Why not do that then?
I'm just saying. There's no point of having the waitress. I mean, forget the waitress. Toll takers, waitresses are gone. They don't need to do that because they'll screw up the bill. Then I don't have to worry about them taking my credit card into the... Well, then again, I could just pay for my watch again. But,
that's right.
But I don't have to worry about them taking my credit card in the back and doing all sorts of weird things with it. Or if I piss them off, you know, if you piss off the waitress, what happens? They spit in your food.
That's right. Exactly.
So I don't have that whole thing. No, but seriously, there's something to be said. If you want something explained, how is it made? Now, this is sales, actually, because, you know, when they come over the table, what we have specials. We have, you know, Italian restaurant. We have three specials today, you know? We got the ossobuco. You got to have the ossobuco. It's unbelievable. Falls right off the bone. All that. Now, if you read that, ossobuco falls right off the bone like butter, delicious. Kind of a different take than if somebody's kind of giving you the mouth-watering discussion of it, don't you think?
I would somewhat agree with that, yeah. But
you guys are no fun. All you do is drink crappy beer and want
what do you mean?
Everybody
we're on the out. We're on the craft beer. Yeah, you know, we've innovated actually quite a bit.
Yeah, no, our generation you've fed up. The only thing I can think about craft beer, and I'm not really schooled on this, it seems like it's not done yet. It's just not done. It's not brewed. It's like they've left the whole hops or something in there, and that's what that bittery stuff is.
Maybe.
I mean, but you know more about that.
I mean, I don't know much about it. I'm more of a stout and porter drinker. I think most of the craft beers nowadays are, you know, these hop guns and these IPAs. I drink quite a bit of beer, let's be honest. But, you know, I stick to the old favorites.
Yeah. I don't blame you. I like the Asian beers. That's me. You know that. I like all the Asian beers.
Tsingtaos.
Oh, yeah. And, yeah. Sapporos or Kirin's or even some of the Mexicans I like. Beers, that is. Not the people.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
No, I'm kidding. Oh, boy. I'm kidding. All right. So, listen. We talk about robo-advisor. Where's the benefit? Where is the opportunity for robo-advice? We said that
it's
inexpensive.
It's inexpensive. I think it's quite beneficial for people who are new to investing to get them started. And those that believe in really long-term investing or the investment process. And because the fact is that you're moving in to this this investing platform, and it's not a market timing type deal where you're buying now, selling later, or buying today and selling tomorrow. It's a long-term process, and you're believing in the fact that those 8 ETFs are going to be diversified and they're going to perform over the long run.
Now, and most of them only have ETFs, not mutual funds.
That's right. And the reason for that is because they don't charge any commissions for trading. So that's why they can have this agreement with these ETFs that whenever they get traded, they're not going to be charged a fee, which in turn, you know, makes it so that they're only working with a small group of ETF investments, whether it be, you know, like I said, 10 to 15 different ETFs, which may or may not cover the scope of diversification that somebody with a lot more money may need. Because in the end, when the market starts to either turn down or change or whatever, you know, the fact is that you need uncorrelated asset classes to work together in order to provide that cushion.
You know what else you need? You need that waitress. I'll tell you why. Because when you are trying to make a decision and you don't know the decision, and the waitress can help you describe what the food is and tell you what the food is. An advisor, in certain cases, when you're talking about long-term buy and hold, I'm not talking about trading. I'm not talking about market timing. I'm not talking about any about that. Long-term buy and hold. What's the biggest problem with long-term buy and hold for people? Why it doesn't succeed?
It's because people sell at the bottom and they buy at the top.
Right. But with a proper advisor, a buy and hold advisor I'm talking about. I'm talking about buy and hold advisor. What do? They say, hey, buy more at this point, possibly. Take some off the table at this time, possibly. Rotate it differently. Or possibly
reassess
even...
reassess your risk.
Or hold your feet to the fire. Say, hey, you know what? You're reminding them. You're in this for the long haul. Because what's going to happen is, while things are okay and things are just spurting along just fine, money will be attracted to these deals. But because they are internet-based, nobody to stop you. There's no... what's the word I'm looking for here? There's no gatekeepers with this. So what happens is that when people freak out, which they will, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, what are they going to do? They're going to rip their money right out of there.
Exactly.
They're going to forget all about the whole idea that there was this long-term aspect to this, that, you know, this is kind of, you got to stay in this thing for a while, let it just run its way and kind of forget about it. Set it and forget it concept, right?
That's true. And our generation is the instant gratification type generation. Yep. So, you know, you're right in the fact that they may be a point in time when the market drops 10 or 15%, people get scared and they pull everything out.
Right. And by the way, you know,
and that's not much different than when we've worked with, you know, some clients in the past. But the fact is, like you said, there's somebody there to say, hey, you know, we have some cash on the side. Maybe we can get this to work. Or, right. Hey, let's reassess your risk. Maybe we can add a little bit more bonds to your portfolio or something that's not, a lot less volatile. So,
Yeah, the other thing is I went to a restaurant last night, great restaurant, new restaurant, kind of a New York style Italian steakhouse, we'll call it. And one of the things I found was really interesting was they're like, you know, to make salamis in particular, you know, prosciuttos and blah, 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 blah. Well, it takes, you know, 6 months in a cave to age this and maybe 2 months for these steaks and all that. But we have these machines that do it in 20 days.
You're talking about old school versus new school.
Right. So I'm like, all right, I'll buy it. So I tasted salami. It tasted okay. It was not like Italy. It was not like it was truly aged.
But did you pay for it like you paid for in Italy?
I don't know.
I don't know. I'm asking because
I don't know the price.
Something takes 6 months to brew, let's say, versus something that takes 2 minutes to brew, the cost factor you would think would be a lot cheaper. And would it be a decent enough substitute product that you could say, hey, well, I'm see, okay
there,
with that?
That's where you go. There's the whole fast food mentality. That's why we eat Chipotle and stuff like that because, you know what, it's okay. It's fine. It does the job. I can deal with it. It's, you know, but I got to tell you something. You taste like, you know, ice cream that I had in Portugal. It's not like this crap yogurt that you get, you know, at these places and all that. You have a good, you know, a piece of meat that's been aged properly at a really fine steakhouse, which, by the way, these days, there's a place down in Miami called Red. It's a steakhouse. And I went there, I think I went there with Frank Curcio actually for dinner. Astonishing the prices. I mean, like
oh, they're crazy.
Mind-boggling, astonishing the prices. Like, mm-hmm. I think the steak was like $450 for this piece of filet.
Oh, that must have been like a Wagyu or
it was a Wagyu,
whatever it is. Yeah.
And I said to him, listen, can I get a forkful? I'll pay $50 for a forkful. No, sorry, you got to have the whole thing. I'm like, no, I don't think so. But the point is, I mean, which is $450 for a steak is a lot.
That's ridiculous.
But the thing is that, you know.
But the fact is that you have the choices. You can do those things.
I agree.
You can choose to have the two-week-old pastrami or whatever, pepperoni or whatever, salami.
Prosciutto.
Or you can choose to go maybe down to Miami that has a place that ages it for 6 months. Yeah, charcuterie or something like that.
Yep, yep. Well, anyway. All right, so we talked about robo-advising. We're going to have more about this because we're looking into this from our aspect. You know, for a long time, we have these various models like a global allocation, which, by the way, is not much different than the concept, although we spend a lot more time looking at economic circumstances, looking at underlying trends, looking at person's risk for the global allocations we have for our clients.
And adjusting the investments over time and their various allocations, which is not something...
Like, for example, shortening up duration on bonds, that's not something they'll do.
Right.
You know, you're going to have a bond portfolio.
Yep.
Kind of a broad-based...
Yeah, you have like the TIPS and the corporate high yield, and you have maybe emerging market bonds.
Right. Which may or may not be at the right time, but okay, again, long term, fine. But the fact is that, you know, we're preferring to have much shorter duration bonds on any of the portfolios that are global allocations,
or floating rate. So if interest rates do begin to rise, then we'll be able to combat that.
Exactly. All right. Well, we'll end it there, and we will pick it up again, folks. I'm going to take off next week. One time a year, I take a week off. I think this is my first doing this about 8 years. We've only missed about 6 or 7 shows. If you want to write me, of course, you can do so at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com, or you can follow me on Twitter. Of course, you can go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and find out all the information about this show and show notes that we have on there, past shows. DH Unplugged comes up there as well. As well as if you want more information about the Arrow strategy, which is our algorithmic trading strategy, usually utilizing the S&P 500, short, long, or out. As well as the TDIMG managed growth strategy, which uses options, hedges, as well as individual stocks, and the Arrow as well inside of there, and also the global allocations. So check that out. Of course, go over to triggercharts.com if you have TradeStation. And if you don't have TradeStation, by the way, you can get a 30-day free trial. And it is absolutely, you don't have to have an account. You don't have to fund an account. All you have to do is fill out a little questionnaire and a form. And basically, you can download the information to provide you with the entire link to get the TradeStation up and running, put on the Commander Series, Altimeter, Aileron, whatever particular indicator that you want. Those are the ones we have available on TradeStation. And you could test it for 30 days, which is really cool. They have never had this before, like last month. So that's why I keep on mentioning that. All right. Now, thanks so much, Kevin. I also wanted to mention that you know, how do you hedge a portfolio with some of the things that are happening? A lot of concern in the markets on a global basis. There's maybe some issues about well, earnings in the U.S. are slowing down. There's been a lot of guidance that has been soft. What do you do? And we're going to keep it simple here. Very, very simple. There's a couple different ways. First of all, obviously, you can bring down positions. If you see some gains in your positions, they reach some of the target prices maybe that you had looked at and speculated or at least calculated, then there's maybe the potential to take down some of your positions. You can always add back to them. That's number one. The second thing is you can use things like inverse ETFs, either the singles, the doubles, the triples, depending on how you want to actually play it. You can actually use those to hedge out some of the broad-based risk of markets for a short term. And third, one of the ways you can do it is through options, put options. I would say that probably better to hedge out is some put options that are close to or in the money on maybe the S&P 500, the small caps, etc. We added a position of small cap hedges on the short side, the puts, last week. I think it was on Thursday we started to add some of that positioning. And when you look at the opportunity to utilize options, they have a lot of leverage available to them because basically you're buying a position that is, well, it's levered, it's a derivative. And what happens is that you get the benefit of that move. Now, of course, with options, as I always say, you have to be right twice. You have to be right with direction and you have to be right in timing. So make sure to go out long enough, look at the pricing, look at the comparatives of where that is when you have the VIX low volatility in the markets. The probability is that the options will be priced cheaper than when you have higher volatility. And oftentimes when you do see that there is a very low volatility environment out there, what you can do is it's a good time to start adding small pieces of a hedge. So three different methodologies to easily hedge, just the simplistic way of hedging a portfolio, not any particular position we're not talking about here, but a portfolio from a broad-based scenario. So think about that. Take a look at that, especially in the times that we're seeing now where we're pretty close to the top of the market range. Yet at the same time, a lot of volatility is probably going to come over the next 2 weeks or 3 weeks with this whole Greece issue. Other than that, I wish you a very good week, and we're going to skip next week. As I mentioned, I'm going to be on a quick vacation, and we'll talk after that. Any questions, send it in to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Thanks for joining me. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.